Chapter 7. The Path to Liberation. Introduction. In this chapter, we come to the unique distinguishing feature of the Buddha's teaching. It's supramundane, or world-transcending, Lokuttara, path to liberation. This path builds upon the transformed understanding and deepened perspective on the nature of the world that arise from our recognition of the perils and sensual pleasures, the inevitability of death, and the vicious nature of samsara, themes that we surveyed in the previous chapter. It aims to lead the practitioner to the state of liberation that lies beyond all realms of conditioned existence, to the same sorrowless and stainless bliss of Nibbana that the Buddha himself attained on the night of his enlightenment. This chapter presents texts that offer a broad overview of the Buddha's world-transcending path. The following two chapters will bring together texts that focus more finely on the training of the mind and the cultivation of wisdom, the two major branches of the world-transcending path. I begin, however, with several suttas that are intended to clarify the purpose of this path, illuminating it from different angles. Text 7.1.1. The Shorter Discourse to Malunkyaputta, Majjhima Nikaya 63, shows that the Buddhist path is not designed to provide theoretical answers to philosophical questions. In this sutta, the monk Malunkyaputta approaches the Buddha and demands answers to 10 speculative questions, threatening to leave the Sangha if this demand is not satisfied. Scholars have debated whether the Buddha refused to answer such questions because they are in principle unanswerable, or simply because they are irrelevant to a practical resolution of the problem of suffering. Two collections of suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya, SN 33.1 through 10, and SN 44.7 through 8, make it clear that the Buddha's silence had a deeper basis than mere pragmatic concerns. These suttas show that all such questions are based on an underlying assumption that existence is to be interpreted in terms of a self and a world in which the self is situated. Since these premises are invalid, no answer framed in terms of these premises can be valid, and thus the Buddha must reject the very questions themselves. However, while the Buddha had philosophical grounds for refusing to answer these questions, he also rejected them because he considered the obsession with their solutions to be irrelevant to the quest for release from suffering. This reason is the evident point of the discourse to Malunkyaputta. With its well-known simile of the man shot by the poisoned arrow, whether any of these views is true or not, the Buddha says, there is birth, there is aging, there is death, there are sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, the destruction of which I prescribe here and now. Against the picture of the samsaric background sketched at the end of the previous chapter, this statement now takes on an expanded meaning. The destruction of birth, aging, and death is not merely the end of suffering in a single lifetime, but the end of the immeasurable suffering of repeated birth, aging, and death that we have undergone in the countless eons of samsara. Text 7.1.2. The Greater Discourse on the Simile of the Heartwood, Majjhima Nikaya 29, clarifies from a different angle the Buddha's purpose in expounding his world-transcending Dhamma. The sutta is about a clansman who has gone forth from the household life into homelessness, intent on reaching the end of suffering. Though earnest in purpose at the time of his ordination, once he attains some success, whether a lower achievement, like gain and honor, or a superior one, like concentration and insight, he becomes complacent and neglects his original purpose in entering the Buddha's path. The Buddha declares that none of these stations along the way, not moral discipline, concentration, or even knowledge and vision, is the final goal of the spiritual life. The goal, its heartwood or essential purpose, is unshakable liberation of the mind. And he urges those who have entered the path not to be satisfied with anything less. Text 7.1.3 is a selection of suttas from The Connected Discourses on the Path, Magga Samyutta. These suttas state that the purpose of practicing the spiritual life under the Buddha is the fading away of lust, final nibbana without clinging, the Noble Eightfold Path being the way to attain each of these aims. The Noble Eightfold Path is the classical formulation of the way to liberation, as is already clear from the Buddha's first sermon, in which he calls the Eightfold Path the way to the cessation of suffering. Text 7.2 gives formal definitions of the individual path factors, but does not show correctly how their practice is to be integrated into the life of a disciple. The detailed application will be filled out later in this chapter, and in chapters 8 and 9. Text 7.3 throws a different spotlight on the path than we are accustomed to hear in standard Buddhist rhetoric. While we are often told that the practice of the Buddhist path depends entirely on personal effort, this sutta emphasizes the importance of spiritual friendship. The Buddha declares that spiritual friendship is not merely half the spiritual life, but the whole of it. For the endeavor to attain spiritual perfection is not a purely solitary enterprise, but occurs in dependence on close personal ties. Spiritual friendship gives the practice of the Dhamma an inescapably human dimension and welds the body of Buddhist practitioners into a community united both vertically by the relationship of teacher to students and horizontally by friendships among peers, treading a shared path. Contrary to a common assumption, the eight path factors are not steps to be followed in sequence, one after another. They are more appropriately described as components than as steps. Optimally, all eight factors should be present simultaneously, each making its own distinctive contribution. Like eight interwoven strands of a cable that give the cable maximum strength. However, until that stage is reached, it is inevitable that the factors of the path exhibit some degree of sequence in their development. The eight factors are commonly distributed into three groups as follows. The moral discipline group, Silakkhandha, made up of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The concentration group, Samadhikkhandha, made up of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. 3. The wisdom group, Panyakkhandha, made up of right view and right intention. Within the Nikayas, however, this correlation occurs only once at Majjhima Nikaya 44.1.301, where it is ascribed to the nun, Dhammandina, not to the Buddha himself. It might be said that the two wisdom factors are placed at the beginning because a preliminary right view and right intention are required at the outset of the path, right view providing the conceptual understanding of Buddhist principles that guides the development of the other path factors, right intention, the proper motivation and direction for the development of the path. In the Nikayas, the Buddha often expounds the practice of the path as a gradual training, anupubhasikha, that unfolds in stages from the first step to the final goal. This gradual training is a finer subdivision of the threefold division of the path into moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. Invariably, in the suttas, the exposition of the gradual training begins with the going forth into homelessness and the adoption of the lifestyle of a bhikkhu, a Buddhist monk. This immediately calls attention to the importance of the monastic life in the Buddha's pragmatic vision. In principle, the entire practice of the Noble Eightfold Path is open to people from any mode of life, monastic or lay, and the Buddha confirms that many among his lay followers were accomplished in the Dhamma and had attained the first three or four stages of awakening, up to non-returning, anagami. Theravada commentators say that lay followers can also attain the fourth stage, arahantship, but they do so either on the verge of death or after attainment immediately seek the going forth. The fact remains, however, that the household life inevitably fosters a multitude of mundane concerns and personal attachments that impede the single-hearted quest for liberation. Thus, when the Buddha set out on his own noble quest, he did so by going into homelessness. And after his enlightenment, as a practical way to help others, he established the Sangha, the order of monks and nuns, for those who want to devote themselves fully to the Dhamma unhindered by the cares of household life. The gradual training occurs in two versions, a longer version in the Digha Nikaya and a middle-length version in the Majjhima Nikaya. The principal differences are, 1. The longer version has a more detailed treatment of the observances that pertain to monastic etiquette and ascetic self-restraint. 2. The longer version includes 8 types of higher knowledge, while the middle-length version has 3 types. However, as these 3 types are the ones mentioned in the Buddha's account of his own enlightenment, see text 2.3.2, they are by far the most important. The main paradigm for the longer version of the gradual training is found at Digha Nikaya 2. The middle-length version is at Majjhima Nikaya 27 and Majjhima Nikaya 51, with variants at Majjhima Nikaya 38, Majjhima Nikaya 39, Majjhima Nikaya 53, Majjhima Nikaya 107, and Majjhima Nikaya 125. Here, text 7.4 includes the whole of Majjhima Nikaya 27, which embeds the training in the simile of the elephant's footprint that gives the sutta its name. Text 7.5, an excerpt from Majjhima Nikaya 39, repeats the higher stages of the training as described in Majjhima Nikaya 27, but includes the impressive similes not included in the latter version. The sequence opens with the appearance of a Tathagata in the world and his exposition of the Dhamma. Having heard this, the disciple acquires faith and follows the teacher into homelessness. He then undertakes the rules of discipline that promote the purification of conduct and the right livelihood of an ascetic. The next 3 steps, contentment, restraint of the sense faculties, and mindfulness and clear comprehension, internalize the process of purification and thereby bridge the transition from moral discipline to concentration. The section on the abandonment of the 5 hindrances deals with the preliminary training in concentration. The 5 hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, are the principal obstacles to meditative development, and thus they must be removed for the mind to become collected and unified. The stock passage on the gradual training treats the overcoming of the hindrances only schematically, but other texts in the Nikayas provide more practical instructions, while the Pali commentaries offer even more details. The similes in the version of Majjhima Nikaya 39, see text 7.5, illustrate the joyful sense of freedom that one wins by overcoming the hindrances. The next stage in the sequence describes the attainment of the jhanas, profound states of concentration in which the mind becomes fully absorbed in its object. The Buddha enumerates 4 jhanas, named simply after their numerical position in the series, each more refined and elevated than its predecessor. The jhanas are always described by the same formulas, which in several suttas are augmented by similes of great beauty. Again, see text 7.5. Although wisdom rather than concentration is the critical factor in the attainment of enlightenment, the Buddha invariably includes the jhanas in the gradual training for at least 2 reasons. First, because they contribute to the intrinsic perfection of the path. And second, because the deep concentration they induce serves as a basis for the arising of insight. The Buddha calls the jhanas the footsteps of the Tathagata, Majjhima Nikaya 27:19-22, and shows them to be precursors of the bliss of Nibbana that lies at the end of the training. From the 4th jhana, 3 alternative lines of further development become possible. In a number of texts outside the stock passage on the gradual training, the Buddha mentions 4 meditative states that continue the mental unification established by the jhanas. These states, described as the liberations that are peaceful and formless, are further refinements of concentration, distinguished from the jhanas by their transcendence of the subtle mental image that serves as the object in the jhanas. They are named the base of the infinity of space, the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. A second line of development is the acquisition of supernormal knowledge. The Buddha frequently refers to a set of six types, which come to be called the six kinds of direct knowledge. Chalabhinya. The last of these, the knowledge of the destruction of the taints, is supramundane, or world-transcending, and thus marks the culmination of the third line of development. But the other five are all mundane, products of the extraordinarily powerful mental concentration achieved in the fourth jhana. The supernormal powers, the divine ear, the ability to read the minds of others, the recollection of past lives, and the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. See text 8.4. The jhanas and the formless attainments by themselves do not issue in enlightenment and liberation. Though lofty and peaceful, they can only silence the defilements that sustain the round of rebirths, but cannot eradicate them. To uproot the defilements at the most fundamental level, and thereby arrive at enlightenment and liberation, the meditative process must be directed to a third line of development. This is the contemplation of things as they really are, which results in increasingly deeper insights into the nature of existence and culminates in the final goal, the attainment of arahantship. This line of development is the one that the Buddha pursues in the passage on the gradual training. He prefaces it with descriptions of two of the direct knowledges, the recollection of past lives and the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. The three together figured prominently in the Buddha's own enlightenment, as we saw in text 2.3.2, and are collectively called the three true knowledges, tivijja. Although the first two are not essential to the realization of arahantship, the Buddha probably includes them here because they reveal truly vast and profound dimensions of suffering in samsara, thereby preparing the mind for the penetration of the Four Noble Truths, by which that suffering is diagnosed and surmounted. The passage on the gradual training does not explicitly show the process of contemplation by which the meditator develops insight. The whole process is only implied by the mention of its final fruit, called the knowledge of the destruction of the taints, asavakkhayanjana. The asavas, or taints, are a classification of defilements considered in their role of sustaining the forward movement of the process of birth and death. The commentaries derive the word from a root su, meaning to flow. Scholars differ as to whether the flow implied by the prefix a is inward or outward. Hence, some have rendered it as influxes or influences, others as outflows or effluents. A stock passage in the suttas indicates the term's real significance independently of etymology when it describes the asavas as states that defile, bring renewal of existence, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. Majjhima Nikaya 36.47. 1. 250. Thus, other translators, bypassing the literal meaning, have rendered it cankers, corruptions, or taints. The three taints mentioned in the Nikayas are respectively synonyms for craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and ignorance. When the disciple's mind is liberated from the taints by the completion of the path of arahantship, he reviews his newly won freedom and roars his lion's roar. Birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. Chapter 7. The Path to Liberation. Part 1. Why does one enter the path? Verse 1. The arrow of birth, aging, and death. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi, in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. 2. Then, while the Venerable Malunkyaputta was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in his mind. These speculative views have been left undeclared by the Blessed One, set aside and rejected by him, namely, the world is eternal. And the world is not eternal. The world is finite, and the world is infinite, The soul is the same as the body, and the soul is one thing and the body another. And after death, a Tathagata exists. And after death, a Tathagata does not exist. And after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. And after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. The Blessed One does not declare these to me, and I do not approve of and accept this fact, so I shall go to the Blessed One and ask him the meaning of this. If he declares to me either the world is eternal, or after death a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, then I will lead the spiritual life under him. If he does not declare these to me, then I will abandon the training and return to the lower life. 3. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Malunkyaputta rose from meditation and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told him, "Here, Venerable Sir, while I was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in my mind. These speculative views have been left undeclared by the Blessed One. If he does not declare these to me, then I will abandon the training and return to the lower life. If the Blessed One knows the world is eternal, let the Blessed One declare to me the world is eternal. If the Blessed One knows the world is not eternal, let the Blessed One declare to me the world is not eternal. If the Blessed One does not know either the world is eternal or the world is not eternal, then it is straightforward for one who does not know and see to say, 'I do not know and see.' If the Blessed One knows the world is finite, the world is infinite, the soul is the same as the body, the soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Tathagata exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. If the Blessed One knows, after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist, let the Blessed One declare that to me. If the Blessed One knows, after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, let the Blessed One declare that to me. If the Blessed One does not know either after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist, or after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, then it is straightforward for one who does not know and see to say, 'I do not know and see.'" 4. "How then, Malunkyaputta, did I ever say to you, 'Come, Malunkyaputta, lead the spiritual life under me and I will declare to you, the world is eternal,' or 'After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist?' No, Venerable Sir. Did you ever tell me, 'I will lead the spiritual life under the Blessed One, and the Blessed One will declare to me, the world is eternal,' or 'After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist?' No, Venerable Sir. That being so, misguided man, who are you, and what are you abandoning?" 5. "If anyone would say thus, 'I will not lead the spiritual life under the Blessed One until the Blessed One declares to me, the world is eternal,' or 'After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist,' that would still remain undeclared by the Tathagata, and meanwhile that person would die. Suppose, Malunkyaputta, a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon to treat him. The man would say, 'I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a Khatiya, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker.' And he would say, 'I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know the name and clan of the man who wounded me, until I know whether the man who wounded me was tall, short, or of middle height, until I know whether the man who wounded me was dark, brown, or golden-skinned, until I know whether the man who wounded me lives in such a village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow that wounded me was a long bow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring that wounded me was fiber, reed, sinew, hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft that wounded me was wild or cultivated, until I know with what kind of feathers the shaft that wounded me was fitted, whether those of a vulture, a heron, a hawk, a peacock, or a stork, until I know with what kind of sinew the shaft that wounded me was bound, whether that of an ox, a buffalo, a deer, or a monkey, until I know what kind of arrowhead it was that wounded me, whether spiked or razor-tipped, or curved, or barbed, or calf-toothed, or lancet-shaped. All this would still not be known to that man, and meanwhile he would die. So too, Malunkyaputta, if anyone should say thus, I will not lead the spiritual life under the Blessed One until the Blessed One declares to me, the world is eternal, or after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. That would still remain undeclared by the Tathagata, and meanwhile that person would die. 6. Malunkyaputta, if there is the view, the world is eternal, the spiritual life cannot be lived. If there is the view, the world is not eternal, the spiritual life cannot be lived. Whether there is the view the world is eternal, or the view the world is not eternal, there is birth, there is aging, there is death. There are sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, the destruction of which I prescribe here and now. If there is the view the world is finite, the world is infinite, the soul is the same as the body, the soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Tathagata exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. The spiritual life cannot be lived. If there is the view, after death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist, the spiritual life cannot be lived. And if there is the view, after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, the spiritual life cannot be lived. Whether there is the view after death a Tathagata both exists and does not exist, or the view after death a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, there is birth, there is aging, there is death. There are sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair, the destruction of which I prescribe here and now. 7. Therefore, Malunkyaputta, remember what I have left undeclared as undeclared, and remember what I have declared as declared. And what I have left undeclared? The world is eternal. I have left undeclared. The world is not eternal. I have left undeclared. The world is finite. I have left undeclared. The world is infinite. I have left undeclared. The soul is the same as the body. I have left undeclared. The soul is one thing and the body another. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata exists. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata both exists and does not exist. I have left undeclared. After death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. I have left undeclared. 8. Why have I left that undeclared? Because it is unbeneficial. It does not belong to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I have left it undeclared. 9. And what have I declared? This is suffering, I have declared. This is the origin of suffering, I have declared. This is the cessation of suffering, I have declared. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, I have declared. 10. Why have I declared that? Because it is beneficial. It belongs to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. It leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I have declared it. Therefore, Malunkyaputta, remember what I have left undeclared as undeclared, and remember what I have declared as declared. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Malunkyaputta was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Majhima Nikaya 63. Kulamalunkaya Sutta 1.426 through 432. Verse 2. The Heartwood of the Spiritual Life. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Rajagha, on Mount Vulture Peak. It was soon after Devadatta had left. There, referring to Devadatta, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus. 2. Monks, here, some clansmen goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others thus, I obtain gain and renown, but these other monks are unknown, of no account. He becomes intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, he lives in suffering. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark and its outer bark. He would cut off its twigs and leaves and take them away thinking they were heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, this good man did not know the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, or the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, he came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, he cut off its twigs and leaves and took them away thinking they were heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. So too is it with this monk who becomes intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown. This monk is called one who has taken the twigs and leaves of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. 3. Here, monks, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering, I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He does not become intoxicated with that gain, honor, and renown. He does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent, he achieves the attainment of moral discipline. He is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others thus. I have moral discipline. I am of good character. But these other monks are immoral, of bad character. He becomes intoxicated with that attainment of moral discipline, grows negligent, falls into negligence. And being negligent, he lives in suffering. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree, standing, possessed of heartwood, passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, and its inner bark, he would cut off its outer bark and take it away, thinking it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, "This good man did not know the heartwood, or the twigs and leaves." Thus, while kneading heartwood, he cut off its outer bark and took it away, thinking it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. So too is it with this monk who becomes intoxicated with that attainment of moral discipline. This monk is called one who has taken the outer bark of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. 4. Here, monks, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering, "I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known." When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. Being diligent, he achieves the attainment of moral discipline. He is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He does not become intoxicated with that attainment of moral discipline. He does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent, he achieves the attainment of concentration. He is pleased with that attainment of concentration, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others thus, "I am concentrated, my mind is unified." But these other monks are scatter-minded, with their minds astray. He becomes intoxicated with that attainment of concentration, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, he lives in suffering. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing, possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood and its sapwood, he would cut off its inner bark and take it away, thinking it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, "This good man did not know the heartwood, or the twigs and leaves." Thus, while kneading heartwood, he cut off its inner barks and took it away, thinking it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. So too is it with this monk who becomes intoxicated with that attainment of concentration. This monk is called one who has taken the inner bark of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. 5. Here, monks, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering, "I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. Being diligent, he achieves the attainment of moral discipline. He is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline, but his intention is not fulfilled. Being diligent, he achieves the attainment of concentration. He is pleased with that attainment of concentration, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He does not become intoxicated with that attainment of concentration. He does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent, he achieves knowledge and vision. He is pleased with that knowledge and vision, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others thus, "I live knowing and seeing, but these other monks live unknowing and unseeing." He becomes intoxicated with that knowledge and vision, grows negligent, falls into negligence, and being negligent, he lives in suffering. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood, he would cut off its sapwood and take it away, thinking it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, "This good man did not know the heartwood or the twigs and leaves. Thus, while kneading heartwood, he cut off its sapwood and took it away, thinking it was heartwood." Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. So too is it with this monk who becomes intoxicated with that knowledge and vision. This monk is called one who has taken the sapwood of the spiritual life and stopped short with that. 6. Here, monks, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the household life into homelessness, considering, "I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known." When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is not pleased with that gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. When he is diligent, he achieves the attainment of moral discipline. He is pleased with that attainment of moral discipline, but his intention is not fulfilled. When he is diligent, he achieves the attainment of concentration. He is pleased with that attainment of concentration, but his intention is not fulfilled. When he is diligent, he achieves knowledge and vision. He is pleased with that knowledge and vision, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He does not become intoxicated with that knowledge and vision. He does not grow negligent and fall into negligence. Being diligent, he attains perpetual emancipation, and it is impossible for that monk to fall away from that perpetual liberation. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off only its heartwood, he would take it away, knowing it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, "This good man knew the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, and the twigs and leaves." Thus, while kneading heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, he came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, and cutting off only its heartwood, he took it away, knowing it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will be served. So too is it with this monk who attains perpetual liberation. 7. So this spiritual life, monks, does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of moral discipline for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable liberation of mind that is the goal of this spiritual life, its heartwood, and its end. This is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Majjhima Nikaya 29. Mahasaropama Sutta 1, 192 through 197.